Today's guests have written a book that's been out in the UK and Europe and is just now being released in the US. And in the UK, The Guardian of London says, quote, it might be the most important book of the year, unquote, and The New Statesman named it one of the top 10 books of the past decade. Let me read you one of the first paragraphs in the book, and I think it'll set the stage. This is reading from chapter one. It is a remarkable paradox that at the pinnacle of human material and technical achievement, we find ourselves anxiety-ridden, prone to depression, worried about how others see us, unsure of our friendships, driven to consume, and with little or no community life. Lacking the relaxed social contact and emotional satisfaction we all need, we seek comfort in overeating, obsessive shopping and spending, or become prey to excessive alcohol, psychoactive medicines, and illegal drugs. How is it that we have created so much mental and emotional suffering, despite levels of wealth and comfort unprecedented in human history? Now I'm switching to me. That was the quote. It's well established that in rich societies, the poor have shorter lives and suffer more from almost every social problem. But now this book, The Spirit Level, based on 30 years of research, shows that more unequal societies are bad for almost everyone, the well-off as well as the poor. Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett show conclusively that the well-being of whole societies is correlated not with average income, but rather with the size of the disparity of income between the top 20% and the bottom 20%. In the most unequal countries, the wealthiest are less healthy and happy than their counterparts in more equal ones. Among developed nations, only Singapore has greater inequality than the United States. Not only that, but they've applied their research to the United States and found their findings are also true when they compare the 50 states by equality and inequality. They highlight a number of graphs. One that shows how health and social problems are worse in more unequal countries. The U.S. is off by itself in a corner of the chart, basically off the charts in both income inequality and worse health and social problems. The same with prevalence of mental illness. The U.S. by far the most mental illness and the most inequality. While not as extreme, the relationship holds true. Listen to this list. Child well-being, illegal drug use, life expectancy, infant mortality, obesity, educational scores, dropout rates, teen pregnancy, teen births, homicide, imprisonment, social mobility, CO2 emissions, rates of innovation, rates of recycling, and finally, levels of trust. All of them have this same relationship in nations or states of greater inequality versus those of less. The good news among all this bad news, if all these ills are related to one measure, income inequality, then here, I'm going to quote the authors again, the evidence shows that even small decreases in inequality, already a reality in some rich market democracies, make a very important difference to the quality of life. Achieving these decreases should be the central goal of our politics, precisely because we can be confident that it works. This is absolutely not, they insist, a utopian dream. Richard Wilkinson has played a leading role in international research on inequality. He studied economic history at the London School of Economics before training in epidemiology. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Nottingham Medical School and honorary professor at the University College London. Kate Pickett is a senior lecturer at the University of York and a National Institute for Health Research career scientist. She studied physical anthropology at Cambridge, nutritional sciences at Cornell, and epidemiology at Berkeley before spending 4 years as an assistant professor at the University of Chicago. Welcome, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett.
Hello, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yes, hello.
Kate's been promoted since she was senior lecturer. She's now a professor too.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Very recent.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So before we launch into those, can each of you choose which one goes first? Tell us a bit about your path to the work you do today, not just why you wrote this book, but how you got to that point.
Well, I'll go first because I've got the longer past. I have been working on the differences in health within societies between rich and poor, or well-educated and badly educated, for a long time. And it's become gradually clearer over time that some of the most important things that affect health in the rich developed world are not simply our material conditions, but what we feel about our circumstances and our situation. So things to do with stress and depression and anxiety and all that kind of stuff. And going from that and the relationships between social status and income and so on and health within societies, I started looking at whether more equal societies with smaller income differences actually had better health. But it was really only when working with Kate that we started to realize that the same pattern was true of so many other social problems.
Okay. And you've got that mixed background of anthropology.
Yes. I mean, both Richard and I have trained in more than one discipline, and I do think that helps us in our work.
I believe so, yeah.
I was also studying the social determinants of health while I was living here in the U.S. I was particularly interested in race and ethnicity and disparities in health among different populations. But when I started, Richard and I met through work, and when we started working together, we began to look beyond health to a range of other kinds of social problems, and our work really developed from there.
One thing, let me say right away at the top, people in the U.S., I think of the U.S. as the rugged individualists and the U.K. as more egalitarian, having a safety net, you know, accusations of socialized medicine, et cetera, et cetera. Yet you started first with this study looking at the U.K. and then broadened out, correct?
Well, really interested in all the rich developed societies. And most of the research on health inequalities it started off, I suppose, in the UK, but spread quickly to other countries. But I've been looking at some of these things since the late 1970s.
I know you tell stories in the book. Can you kind of tell the story of how this book happened? By that, I mean when you said, you know, kind of eureka, we've got something. There's something here that needs to be put out. But also, I understand you didn't jump to this conclusion.
No, in fact, looking back on it, I think I was incredibly slow to realize that the pattern by which health seems to be better and life expectancy longer in societies with smaller income differences, although we all have intuitions, or many people have an intuition that, you know, inequality is divisive and socially corrosive, I think I thought that you'd only see the effects of that if you looked at, you know, if there were kind of utopian, perfectly equal societies. But in the real world, with the inequality we all have to cope with wherever we are, I thought you wouldn't ever see any differences. And so I didn't look at the figures. But gradually, you know, I became aware that some people had shown that violence was more common in more unequal societies, and then we saw that trust was worse. And then working with Kate, we found that applied to obesity and teenage birth rates, and then suddenly realizing that actually this was a problem, this was a pattern that applied to nearly all the social problems with social gradients, by which I mean the problems that we all know are worst in the poorest areas of our societies, at the, if you like, the bottom end of the social ladder.
And, of course, we had been publishing our work in academic journals as we went along, but as I'm sure you know, not many people read those. And we're big fans of radio. I'm sure you'll be glad to hear. Yeah. And we wake up every morning listening to news program on the radio. And we would hear the kinds of problems we're discussing, drug use, kids dropping out of school, that sort of thing, discussed in the news every day. And often academics would be brought on to discuss these problems. Experts would be brought on to talk about policies to fix them. And we never heard inequality mentioned as a root cause. So we felt that we really needed to write something that people would read beyond the research community and try and get this work better known.
Yeah, at one stage it was really bizarre because they were talking about how terribly overcrowded our prisons were, building more prisons, governments allowing prisoners out of prison early, at a time when crime rates had been declining for quite a while, and not a single mention of inequality. And yet, if you put rates of imprisonment on a graph against levels of inequality in a society, if you know a society's level of inequality, you can just about read off what level of imprisonment it's going to have. It's quite extraordinary. And the same applies, well, it's not such a close relationship, but it's still a strong relationship amongst the 50 states of the U.S.
Let me ask you this. There's a particular format that I like sometimes, and I'm not sure if it fits this issue or not. So let me just throw it out to you and tell me whether you think it fits. If it fits, we'll go on from there. I call it It's Broke, Let's Fix It, and it's basically three questions about an issue. So here it would be, you know, it would be all these issues, but the first is, how is it broken? What's the evidence? The second is, how did it get broken? What are the causes in the history? And the third is, how do we fix it? What are the solutions? Do you think that's a handy way to deal with this or not?
Yeah, I guess it is.
If what we're saying, it is broken, as we've talked about in this case, it's usually we're talking on a show about healthcare, or we're talking on a show about prisons, or we're, you know, obesity. In this case, it's really the equality, inequality, and all the ripple effects of that. So how is it broken? What's the evidence?
Well, we look at the rich developed countries, and as a separate test, we look at the 50 U.S. states, and we draw on data from reputable sources. You know, a lot of our data come from places like the World Health Organization, the United Nations, the World Bank. Here in the U.S., they often come from the National Center for Health Statistics or the Census, places like that. And we simply look at the correlations between the level of inequality in different societies, measures of income inequality, and a whole range of health and social problems. And we find consistently between the states and the rich developed countries that levels of trust are lower, levels of mental illness are higher, levels of violence and drug use are higher, obesity, imprisonment. We find that teen births are higher, that social mobility is lower, and that educational achievement is lower as well. I've probably missed some out, but the evidence is very consistent across all of these health and social outcomes and in our two independent test beds, and the differences are very large. They can't be explained by chance alone. The statistics we use tell us that. And the differences are enormous. There are eightfold differences between more and less equal countries in teen birth rates, three times the rate of mental illness in more unequal countries. I think it's a 16-fold difference in imprisonment rates and a 10-fold difference in homicide rates. So the differences are very large. It's quite clear that more unequal societies are suffering from a very general social dysfunction.
As you've looked at these, you're looking at data at one sort of cross-section moment. Both the UK and the US have shown great increases in inequality over the past few decades, perhaps from the Reagan-Thatcher era to today. And as I think people point out, Labour got in power and that didn't change. It may have slowed it down. But are these negative consequences, do they increase with increased inequality within the same country?
I think so, but rather little work has been done looking at changes over time. There has been some with health, which shows relationships consistently over time, but we need to do more work on that. However, there are now about, I think, over 200 studies of the relationship between health and levels of income inequality in different societies, and they started, I suppose, using data from the 1970s, and people are still showing relationships despite the fact that we know both health and inequality have changed substantially. And so, you know, if you keep on finding health and inequality together, and you know they're changing, they must be moving together.
Right, exactly. But
we do know that, for instance, teen birth rates and homicide rates rose until the early 90s, while income differences were widening in the states, and since then they've leveled off. Also, there are other people who've commented how social cohesion and levels of trust and so on in America improved throughout the century until sometime in the late 60s, and then inequality started to rise again, and people started to trust each other less, and sense of cohesion and community weakened. So these things do seem to move in parallel over time.
I think one of the reasons why more work hasn't been done looking at changes over time is also the lack of availability of good data. We haven't had great data on income inequality for a lot of different countries for very long, and some of the health and social problem data that we look at is very recent. For instance, the international figures on mental illness were published very recently by the World Health Organization. So although Richard says he was perhaps slow to discover all of this and he should have done it sooner, some of it he couldn't have done. The data simply wouldn't have been there.
Right. That was something that was interesting to me to learn, was that, in fact, you could have an intuition about this and so on, but to lay it out with the enormous data to back it up is only something that's been possible recently.
Yeah, and what's odd is what we've done is so simple, and there are thousands of people doing research in health and social sciences and stuff, and it really should have been done a decade or so earlier. I mean, it's extraordinary that it hasn't been put together until now.
Right. And, I mean, what you're saying also is that if the data was hard to come by, that should have been there too, because people should have been looking at this. And what's your, I mean, I'm sure you've had this conversation many times between yourselves and probably others as to why we've been so slow to see the forest for the trees.
I think that I'm afraid academics have a tendency to believe that the problems that they're working on are incredibly complicated and very easily lose the wood for the trees. But I think that in a way there is a sort of often a kind of denial that goes on. I mean, we all know how extraordinarily sensitive we are to social status and whether people look up to us and admire us or down on us and disrespect us and so on. Yet I think people, you know, if you ask someone, they might say, yeah, I know other people are bothered by social status, but of course not me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of denial of how important and how sensitive we are to these issues was quite important.
Mm-hmm. I also think a lot of it has to do with the way that academics and policymakers work in silos. They're quite compartmentalized.
Yes.
If you study health, you tend not to study violence or educational achievement. And if you're a government department concentrating on education, you tend not to be thinking about preventive health measures.
Or drug problems or crime.
Right. No, I was thinking that it's about, you know, what you're saying. I mean, so much of what you're saying, metaphorically as well as just practically, is about systems and systems-wide sort of things and community-wide. And then, of course, we study these things in specializations. I guess if one's looking at specializations, it would have fallen to economists to look at income inequality, yet they really have not had their eye on that ball either.
Yes, I think that we've all suffered from an idea that I think is particularly strong amongst economists, that the sort of primary relationship is between people and things. You know, this idea that there are possessive individuals and so on, rather than the primary relationship between people. And one of the things the health research has shown over the years is that, for instance, one of the most important protective factors for health is the quality of social relationships. And people have actually done little experiments making puncture wounds on the back of somebody's hand, I mean, volunteers, of course, and measuring how quickly it heals. And it heals more slowly if you have a poor relationship with your partner.
Wow.
Or, for instance, giving people nasal drops with cold viruses in. Again, volunteers, you'll be glad to know. Also giving them questionnaires about the number of friends they have. And you find that people are over four times as likely to catch colds from that same measured exposure to infection if they have few friends. Friendship is extraordinarily important. And gradually we've become aware of how sensitive we are through our the biological stress systems, levels of stress hormones and so on, to the quality of social relationships, which includes the amount of social hierarchy in a society.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking when we watch nature documentaries of social animals, it seems like they always focus on this, you know.
Yes, that's been a very important source of understanding of these problems in human beings. The fact that in human beings you can usually not do very much more than make observations, but in the animals, of course, you can do experiments. And one of the problems about observational studies in human beings is, if you're wondering whether it's material conditions or social status, you can't separate them out easily. And yet, with kinds of monkeys, you can give them the same food, keep them in the same compounds, and you can manipulate their social status by moving animals between groups. And so you can see very clearly what the effects of loss of social status are, for instance, in physiological terms. And we find that many of them are much like the effects of social status in human beings.
And you folks have, I think with some others, set this up because you realize that you've done the research, you've written the book, but there's a movement needed.
That's right. We set the trust up really in an attempt to disseminate the work more widely and get it better known. We think the key to change is people actually understanding there's a problem in the first place. And as we mentioned earlier, we kept encountering situations where health and social problems that do seem to have their roots in greater inequality, inequality wasn't being discussed in relation to them. So we wanted to have an organization, which is primarily a website, to disseminate information and get this better known.
Let people see the evidence on the graphs, for instance. But one of the things that's really important about this, Kate earlier described how big the differences were in outcomes, three times as much mental illness, or, eight times the amount of proportion of teenage births. And
yes, let me just cut in and say, as she was saying that, my jaw was dropping when she got to 10 times and 16 times and things like that. That's just, that's so off the charts.
Yes, they're extraordinary. I think people often think that these would be, maybe we're talking about things being 15% more common, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. 20% more common. It's just quite different from that. And that is because it's not just the poor who are affected by inequality. It's the whole society. The poor seem to be affected most, so the benefits of greater equality are biggest at the bottom of society, but they extend all the way up society. And that we have fairly good data on that from a number of different situations, comparing countries or American states. And so even given your level of income and your level of education, you would do better if you were in a more equal society. The argument is not that you would be richer in a more equal mm-hmm, society. Mm-hmm. It's given your level of income, you would be likely to live a bit longer, your kids would be less likely to be involved in drugs, would be likely to do a bit better at school. But because we now recognize this as something that benefits the vast majority of the population, it changes the whole debate about inequality. It's no longer a matter of encouraging people to be altruistic on behalf of the poor, accept slightly higher tax rates to bail out the poor with benefits. This is something that is about the quality of life for the vast majority of society, and that's why we thought it was really important to get that information out there and set up this website with the help of a Quaker charity in Britain, the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust.
Two things about this. One is that it's good to get this out there, and the other is, as you say, politically, if people can look at evidence like this, can look at those graphs and so on, then the political motivation shifts. And I must say, in the U.S., this constant sort of battle between whether a policy is being sold as helping the poor or helping the poor and middle class or helping all of us is crucial. Let me ask this question first, because of the point you've just made. A critic in the London Review of Books, David Runciman, I'm not sure if I got the pronunciation correct, while praising the book, questions whether your research actually proves your conclusion. And the same question did occur to me. In other words, could the average of negative outcomes in the U.S., for instance, be due to the fact that the poorest are suffering so extremely that the richest could be doing fine, even relative to their counterparts? And when you look at gross averages, that might account for it versus the ill outcome spreading from top to bottom. How do you answer that? He writes, and I'm just going to read this for listeners, this is why the difference between almost everyone and everyone on average matters so much. Politics. If it is almost everyone who would benefit from a more equal society, this is an encouragement to solidarity across social boundaries. But if it is everyone on average, then this can go along with an absence of solidarity and the hardening of divisions because the disadvantages may be unequally distributed.
Yeah, I think Kate should answer that. But before she does, let me just say that we were amazed that he said those things and thought he'd missed out a whole chapter of the book where we really show the data. And there's no question about him being wrong. We replied to his review, but they didn't print the letter. Mm. But anyway, let Kate explain the arguments.
Well, I think, as we've mentioned already, the differences are so vast that they can't possibly be explained by what's happening to the bottom 5 or even 10% of the population. If you have mental illness rates of 26%, then clearly something's affecting many, many more people than just the poor.
That's right. As you're saying, if the lower 20% all had mental illness problems, you'd still, which is, I get what you're saying.
That's
when you get into that orders of scale, it has to be distributed throughout. Go ahead.
But there's also plenty of evidence from research on income inequality and health, where studies actually control for the individual income or education levels of subjects in the study. And they find that there is an effect of income inequality on health, even after taking into account all of the different incomes of the people in the study. And so there's definitely something going on that can't be explained by the proportion of poor people in a society. And, of course, our measures of income inequality actually are independent of the proportions of poor and rich people in society. They're simply measuring the gap. And so his arguments really can't be sustained. And we show in a number of different studies that even among the top third of educated people, health is better in a more equal country than in a less equal one. Or if we look at the most educated parents in more and less equal countries, we can see that children do better in school, even amongst the most highly educated parents in a more equal society than in a less equal one. So I'm afraid his arguments don't really stand up to the evidence.
We're not guessing. The data is there.
Very good. Someone recently reminded me that the word radical has to do with roots, root causes and so on. And so what is really radical about what you're saying is not only that people haven't been saying it, but that it does seem to go to the root of something.
Yes, it's interesting. I think people's the most common response to various different health and social problems, and if there's more crime, people want more police, and if health is bad, they want more doctors and so on, drugs, maybe drug rehabilitation units. We tend to respond by demanding expensive services to address these problems. But those services are only very partially effective. I mean, if you look at medical expenditure or doctors per head of population in the rich developed countries, it doesn't seem to be the most important determinant of life expectancy, for instance. It's very difficult to actually to see any relationship between the two, simply because social and economic factors overwhelm the benefits of medicine. And similarly, people who specialize in understanding crime and policing say that policing isn't one of the main influences on crime. But insofar as any of these things, you know, when they do cure people or when they do prevent crime or whatever, we know these problems are constantly being recreated in our society. For instance, you know, you persuade lots of the health behavior work someone to stop smoking. You know other kids are starting to smoke. You know that people are being pushed into taking drugs and so on. I mean pushed by their circumstances, the anxiety, the unhappiness, whatever it is.
I plan to spend most of the second half here dealing with where do we go from here, that sort of thing. But before I do, can you give a few examples, if you would, of some of the comparisons among states in the U.S., besides just the general notion that it holds true. Do you have at your fingertips some of that? How a state like California, which has enormous wealth, actually ends up charting close to Alabama and Mississippi in so many things because what they do share is great inequality.
That's right, and in fact, the most unequal of the states is actually New York on the government's most recent official figures, although you're right that Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama do cluster there as well. And California, I think I was surprised at how unequal it is. At the more equal end, we have states like Vermont and New Hampshire, but also Iowa, Utah, Wisconsin. So some of the differences we find that levels of trust are very different in the more equal states. About two-thirds of the population feel that other people can be trusted, but it's only around a third in the more unequal states.
Or lower than that, more like a quarter, I think.
Can I ask a question that comes up for me? You mentioned among the more equal, Utah, Vermont, New Hampshire. One thing I also think of is among the least diverse. How much does homogeneity seem to play a role in this?
You go, Kate.
Well, people often ask that question because not only do they look at the more unequal states and think about racial diversity, but they also look at our list of rich developed countries and think, oh, well, there's the USA at one end, they're thinking of it as very ethnically heterogeneous, and there's Japan at the other end, and this is a question that comes up. Part of the answer to that is that, you know, I think at risk of repeating myself, the differences are so large between more and less equal societies that the effects can't possibly be explained by what's happening among minority populations. And also some of the comparisons we make showing the impact of inequality are actually just between the white populations of different countries.
Mm-hmm. I think what probably I'm thinking is not an either-or question. In other words, not is it homogeneity rather than inequality, but that perhaps the two go hand in hand.
I think they do. I think there's a contribution of perhaps from diversity, but that isn't because it's a different kind of problem. It's that any social difference, whether you talk about differences in skin color or linguistic group in some countries or religious beliefs that are divisive in a number of societies, they really cause much bigger problems as soon as they become markers of social status, and so people start looking down on one group, and those markers of social status start to attract stigma, much like the stigma that lower incomes and poverty and so on attract.
And let me ask one other question again before we turn to solutions about the implications of this. I did read in a review, I believe, but again, it's not a bad question. Japan and Sweden, for instance, are among the most equal and the most homogeneous. Is individual expression suppressed in a culture like that? Is there something lost? And this reminds me actually of a book I read maybe 15 years ago from a Brit, and I'm forgetting his name because it just occurs to me right now, but it was a book called 2020, in which he pointed out that the amount of money that the United States wasted in social problems, divorce, obesity, blah, 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 was ultimately canceled out all our advantages in innovation and that sort of thing.
Well, let me start with the issue of individualism in Japan and Sweden. People often point to different countries in our analyses and say, oh, it must be something funny about a particular group of countries that explains it. For instance, they'll often think that there's something different about the English-speaking cultures, and that's why we have more health and social problems in English-speaking countries. Or they'll point to the Scandinavian, the Nordic countries, and think there's something culturally distinct about them. And as you've just mentioned, thinking it's perhaps something that Japan and Sweden have in common around individualism. But actually, you could remove the English-speaking countries from our analysis of income inequality and health and social problems, and there's still a relationship among the remaining countries. In fact, you can take off Japan and the Nordic countries and the English-speaking countries and still find something going on. So clearly, there's something other than particular cultural differences in countries at the extreme ends. There's still a relationship between income inequality and problems in the countries in the middle. And Japan and Sweden are so different in so many ways. If you think about their culture, the position of women, how closely they hold to the nuclear family, you couldn't really have two countries more different. But I'll let Richard talk about innovation and that in relation to inequality.
Thank you, yeah.
Yes, it was interesting. Kate was on a BBC program in London and was challenged by a senior conservative politician who said, okay, supposing we accept that inequality has all these damaging social consequences, surely we depend for the innovation and creativeness that drive the economy really on America because of the incentives and individualism and the huge inequality. Difficult for Kate to answer that off the top of her head, but I think she managed to mention Nokia and Sony in more equal countries. But then when we got home, we thought, well, how can we measure innovation and inventiveness, creativity, as it affects the economy? And we thought the best way would be to look at patents. Or I think you say patents,
patents
per head of
exactly,
population.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can get figures on that quite easily. And although it's not a very close relationship, they tend to be significantly higher in more equal countries.
Yeah, that was, I must say, by the way, that was one of the graphs that really struck me. And it's patents per millions in population or something. And,
yes.
And there was a pretty direct relationship. Equal societies have more patents per million.
It's interesting. You can, I suspect it's partly because of the low social mobility, the scale at which people drop out of high school in the more unequal states, or internationally, the low maths and literacy scores in countries with great inequality, that there's a waste of a good proportion of a society's talent. But I also think that maybe in the background we have two different ideas about how people are most likely to be creative. Is it driven by sticks and carrots, incentives and so on? Or are people most creative when they feel at ease with each other, a group of equals, you know, where you can spark ideas off each other? And I suspect that maybe that's the better way.
When you scratch, okay, you find that it seems to be about equality and inequality. But when you scratch that, what I hear you saying over and over again is social cohesion, feeling part of a community, feeling trust. That was that. And so many of your graphs are about, as we've said, obesity, crime, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have the one on trust, which seems to me to really be opening up to what's really underneath all this. You agree?
Yes, I do. I think that really to understand it, you have to go into the sort of fundamentals of human social relationships. And of course, through most of our evolution, most of the period of time over which we've looked and had brains the size we do now, human beings lived in remarkably egalitarian hunting and gathering groups based on food sharing and reciprocity. I think people imagine that, for instance, consumerism is a sign that of how materialistic people are. But actually, if you think what consumerism is about, it's wanting to show ourselves off well in relation to each other. It's to do with how we're seen and experience ourselves through each other's eyes. It's about status competition. And so what motivates what appears to be materialism is actually a highly social aspect of ourselves. And what I think we're dealing with at bottom is a sort of choice human beings have. Whether we live in societies where we trust each other, cooperate, and depend on reciprocity and so on, or whether we form dominance hierarchies based on power and coercion, where the name of the game is competition. And that changes the nature of the social relationships. You know, other people can be the best or the worst. They can be our greatest rivals for food and shelter, sexual partners, whatever. Or they can be our best source of help, security, love, assistance. And which they are has always been absolutely fundamental determinant of well-being. And that explains, I think, why we are so sensitive to low social status, but also why there are these extraordinary benefits that we see in the health research of friendship.
And long-standing relationships and marriages, et cetera, et cetera. The good news, as I said in the introduction, is if so many ills are linked, then the evidence shows that these social ills can be addressed with one basic strategy. I mean, I think one of the things that really made me, as I was reading, kind of, you know, a smile as well as an aha, was that if, as you pointed out earlier in our conversation, you approach crime from your specialization of crime, and obesity from your specialization of obesity, and education from, you know, you end up doing an awful lot of things, and you're pulling at different threads of the thing. But what you're saying is that if we really can see that this makes that much difference, then we have sort of a unified approach that could be more effective, more efficient, et cetera, across the board.
That's right. I mean, I think it gives us a unified idea of a whole range of things we might be able to fix, and a notion of what it is we need to fix to get there. What it doesn't tell us is which particular pathways towards increasing greater equality might work or be most beneficial. But one of the things that's clear from both our international analysis and our analysis of the US states is that it doesn't actually seem to matter much how you get your greater equality, just that you get there somehow. At the very equal end of our group of rich developed market democracies, we have Japan and Sweden. And Sweden has quite large income differences to start with, but achieves its greater equality through higher taxes and redistribution benefits, a bigger state. And in Japan, those income differences are smaller to start with, so its inequality comes from having a narrower gap in incomes before taxes and any redistribution. And we find something of the same pattern in the U.S. states. For instance, Vermont and New Hampshire, their neighbors share a border culturally very similar. New Hampshire's a bit more like Japan in having low state taxation and low social expenditure, and Vermont a bit more like Sweden with higher taxation and greater social spending. But because they both manage through different routes to be more among the more equal states, they have lower levels of health and social problems. So different routes to equality, and it doesn't seem to matter. You just need to get there somehow.
Yes, I think we feel that it's sufficiently urgent to need to pursue greater equality through both routes. But the weakness of relying just on taxes and benefits is, of course, even if you manage to get a change. And remember, top tax rates in the past, I mean, in the United States, I think in the 60s and 70s, they were up somewhere around 80 or 90%.
We did have a 90% upper taxation rate in the 60s. I'm not sure it stretched into the 70s, but
and
there you go.
It's just extraordinary that we now think it's inconceivable to get anywhere near that.
Right, I think 35 is
But the danger of relying on that approach is simply that it can all be undone so easily by a different government. So we think it's really important to embed greater equality more fundamentally in the structure of our institutions, and increasingly, I think, in terms of greater economic and workplace democracy. And in a way, the bonus culture, the huge incomes at the top, that and what's happened over the last few decades is the rich have run away from the rest of us with this bonus culture. But that has only been possible because of the complete lack of any democratic constraints on them. You know, that they're not employee representatives on the board of many companies, that there aren't enough employee-owned companies, that there aren't enough mutuals and cooperatives and what's the other thing?
Friendly societies.
Friendly societies,
like
yeah, things like that, where there are other forms of democratic control which make it more embarrassing for the most senior people to award themselves these huge increases while holding down pay demands lower in the social hierarchy.
You say you considered naming the book Evidence-Based Politics.
That's right, yes.
A, tell me a little about that and the decision, what that means and the decision not to. But it also sounds like you two do not believe, having made the diagnosis, that the treatment is political.
Let's start with the title. I mean, I suppose, as epidemiologists, we're well aware of the rise in what's called evidence-based medicine, that treatments should only be chosen if there's evidence that they're actually effective, rather than just chosen by the individual whim of a physician. And that's been a very, I think, important movement in medicine and in public health, you know, that we should only use treatments that are shown to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an idea, I think, in Britain about policy and politics should be based on evidence as well. And we felt that really we were providing an evidence base for policymakers and politicians. And so we thought that was quite a good title. But our publisher in England disagreed with us. And so we ended up with the title we have.
And let me quickly ask about spirit level. Are you using the metaphor of a carpenter's level there?
Yes, that's right. We only realized when we came to the U.S. A couple of weeks ago that a lot of people here don't understand that term, that, you know, what we call a spirit level is what you call a carpenter's level or just a level. We quite like the idea of public-spiritedness as well being expressed by the title, but we have seen the book referred to over here as the spirituality level. I think it's perhaps giving the wrong impression.
Yeah. So let me just see. There are a lot in there where when you get into solutions, you are skeptical as I think you both, but certainly Richard, has expressed that politics can do it enough. Let me read a quote from you guys. For several decades, progressive politics have been seriously weakened by the loss of any concept of a better society. People have argued for piecemeal improvements in different areas of life, but nowhere is there a popular movement capable of inspiring people with a vision of how to make society a substantially better place to live for the vast majority. Without that vision, politics will rarely provoke more than a yawn. Sarkozy is challenging economists to develop a successor to GDP to measure a nation's wealth and growth. There are, I think, also this current recession, which seems to have been caused to a great extent by greed and by those who made the most money from the excesses that got us into so much trouble. This seems like a teachable moment. Is there a political angle here? Is it really a cultural movement, or is it a bit of both?
I think it's more than a bit of both. I think we need really fundamental changes in our society. Perhaps during the next generation or so, politics are going to be dominated either by the problem of reining in carbon emissions or with the consequences in terms of climate change from our failure to do so. And it's quite clear that our societies have to go through a fundamental change of direction. In a way, the greatest threat to climate change and the ability of governments to reduce carbon emissions is consumerism. And it's clear that consumerism is really driven by status competition, which is amplified by greater inequality. And so one of the ways of reducing carbon emissions, or to make it easier to do that, is by reducing inequality. But more than anything else, dealing with climate change involves a sort of public-spiritedness, a regard for the welfare, if you like, of humanity at large.
And for humanity that will come after.
Yes, indeed. And one of the very clear patterns that's emerging from the data is that just as more equal societies, the levels of trust are much higher, the involvement in community life is higher, less violence and so on, what that means is that people are more public-spirited. They're less out for themselves. And you can see this, I mean, we tested it by taking a number of outcomes which involve that kind of public-spiritedness. One of them was, for instance, what proportion of waste is recycled in different countries? We looked at we got data for different waste materials. Or how much of national income do governments give in aid to developing countries? And again, it's significantly higher in more equal countries. Even surveys of business leaders' opinions internationally, one of the questions we found people had been asked was, how important do you think it is for your governments to abide by international environmental agreements? And that was rated more highly, again, in more equal countries. So all those things show a sort of a greater regard for the public good, the good of humanity, if you like.
That's right. Who knows which is the chicken and which is the egg, correct?
Yeah, because you see, greater inequality, where we feel more judged by social status, pushes us into that consumerism, that status mm-hmm. competition, which people increasingly know is empty. You know, there are surveys here in the U.S. that show that most people feel they sacrifice more important values like family and friends and community and so on to that sort of individualistic consumerism. And one of the funny things that these surveys have shown is that people imagine that's their sort of private view of it, but everyone else is, you know, solidly consumerist. And apparently, when they got them together in focus groups, they were delighted to find that actually that perspective was quite widely shared. They all thought it would be a good thing to have more time for each other and that consumerism was pretty hollow. I think people also know that economic growth no longer produces the goods it used to produce. I mean, people, you know, increasingly say, weren't we just as happy in the past?
Right. No, I know that's a big point you make, is that perhaps this whole economic growth, for the most part, now, not so true of the poorest societies, but in the developed, I mean, yes, in other words, one thing we haven't dealt with here is the difference between rich and poor countries, and you're not discounting that at all, but what you basically state that in the advanced countries, economic growth has kind of reached its point, its diminishing returns.
That's right, and I think it's also important to say, you know, before we close, that we're not talking about unachievable utopian levels of equality. The countries we compare are all rich countries. They're all capitalist countries with markets. But we see, you know, such clear differences from even quite small shifts in equality. And the other thing I think we encounter sometimes is the idea that it's somehow anti-American to want society to be more egalitarian and more equal. And yet you've been one of the most equal of the developed countries in your quite recent past, and certainly your nation was founded on ideals of opportunity, fairness, and democracy.
Getting away from the old European feudal aristocracy and class-based societies and so on.
So I think our work fits very closely with American ideals and shows a way in which societies can sort of become the best they can be for the vast majority of their citizens.
I'm going to let us leave it at that. The book is The Spirit Level, Why More Equal Societies Almost Always Do Better. The website is EqualityTrust, one word, EqualityTrust.org.uk, EqualityTrust.org.uk. Thank you, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. Keep up your good work.
Thank you.